Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting today with a very bright gentleman, Mr. Jim Rogers, who's author of Street Smarts, Adventures on the Road and in the Markets. And Jim, we were talking in the last segment that you're long the U.S. dollar because it's been perceived as a safe haven. Along that same line of thinking, where would you place gold?
Well, I own gold, and I have for a long time, but I haven't bought any gold or silver in a few years because gold went up too much. It had an anomaly of going up 12 years in a row without a decline, and now it's having a long correction, a well-needed correction, so I'm not buying. I expect another opportunity to buy gold sometime in the next year or two. If that happens, I hope I'm smart enough to buy a lot of gold, a lot more gold. Gold, in the end, is probably going to wind up as a bubble itself, you know, because people, when we lose confidence in paper money, when we lose confidence in governments, gold will go through the roof. It's been seen as a refuge for a long time, and it will be again.
So, Jim, at a certain point, you mentioned that the U.S. dollar is flawed, and you mentioned that people eventually lose faith in paper currencies when too much is printed or created. Do you see at some point some country in the world going back to a gold exchange standard and keeping other currencies honest?
Well, the gold standard's been tried several times in history. It's never worked. It's never lasted very long because politicians always figure out a way to get around it or cheat on it. You know, they debase it or they change the rules or whatever. So even the gold standard has not lasted very long. Silver has been used much more often in history than gold, but same thing. I mean, politicians always find a way to cheat us and to make the public lose money. And the ones who lose the most, of course, are the ones who believe the politicians. And believe what they say when they say it. So, yes, it may be that. I mean, if the world collapsed tomorrow, we would probably grab for gold because we don't know what else to do. I might try SDRs, the special drawing rights from the IMF. I cannot conceive that the special drawing rights from the IMF would work because people like to think they have something in their pocket or something they can see and talk and. Just a bunch of bureaucrats saying this is money has not usually been accepted by people. So, yeah, we might try gold, but, again, I don't think gold would last because very long because, again, politicians always find a way to get around it. And if you could have a strict gold standard or strict any kind of standard, it might work. The best solution, Dennis, is to have a free market in money. That's what has worked throughout history. There were many times in history when we could use goats or cows or silver or seashells. Or whatever we wanted is money. That's the best way because then the politicians cannot control us and cannot control the money. But even that fails because they always change the rules.
So, Jim, since you said a free money system, do you have an opinion on some of the cryptocurrencies that have developed over the past several years, like Bitcoin?
Well, I don't really know enough about them. I do know, Dennis, that the world needs something. We were just discussing how the world needs something to compete with U.S. dollar and eventually replace the U.S. dollar. And we do know that the Internet or the computer is changing everything and will continue to change everything we know. So it could very well be that some kind of electronic money or computer system eventually replaces or competes with money as we know it. The risk there, of course, is that then the politicians have complete control, even more so than now. If you and I have money in our backyard or gold in our backyard, they don't know it and they can't control it. But once, if all money is on the computer or electronic, then they can just snatch it from us whenever they want to.
So, Jim, going back to the gold and silver conversation, would you have a position that you'd be more bullish on gold or silver? Would you favor one metal over the other?
Well, at the moment, silver is cheaper on a historic basis than gold. So probably if I had to buy one today, and I'm not buying either today, I would probably buy silver just because on a historic basis, relative basis, it's cheaper.
Jim, let's talk about oil prices. Oil prices have been collapsing. To what can this be attributed in your view, and does this trend continue?
Well, if you go back and look at your chart, you'll see that oil peaked last the summer of 2014. That's when America was intensely negotiating with Iran. And so we went to Saudi Arabia and said, all right, dump oil. Let's put pressure on them. The deadline was July 31st, and the charts almost exactly mesh. Saudi Arabia wanted to do something about fracking, so they were willing to dump oil. America was trying to put pressure on Iran and Russia. Saudi Arabia dumped oil, got the price down, had a big collapse. Normally when you have a big collapse, Dennis, you then have a bounce, a dead cat bounce, it's often referred to. So we had the dead cat bounce, and then nearly always in markets, they go back to test the lows to see if those lows were the final lows. That's what we're doing. I suspect we are making our lows. Maybe it's a complicated bottom here and as we speak, and maybe a few more weeks or months. But the fundamentals for oil continue to get improved because the world has consumed more oil than it has discovered for quite some time now. And you see some of the major oil companies have reduced their reserves by a billion barrels here in the last recent past. So the fundamentals get better, except for fracking. Now, fracking has been a wonderful thing, brought a lot of oil on, but those wells are very short-lived, first of all, and second, they can't make money at $40 or $50 oil. So I would suspect we're making a bottom, and that even if the world doesn't recover economically, the shortages of oil are going to develop again, and so we're probably making our bottom, or near our bottom. It doesn't mean it can't go lower. You know, you can always have a double bottom that's a false breakdown, but I suspect that's what's happening now.
What's your take, Jim, on base metals? With the Chinese economy slowing, we're seeing many commodities, including base metals, in a downtrend. What's your outlook there?
Well, you're exactly right, partly because so much some more base metal production came online. I more or less have the same view of base metals than I do of oil. It just takes a little longer to bring base metals on stream or to turn them off than it does oil. But I would suspect that we're seeing a bottom in base, a complicated bottom in base metals as well. If you want a commodity, Dennis, I would find agriculture most promising, but all commodities, all assets at the moment are under duress and suspect because of this artificial money printing we've had for so long, and that's caused serious distortions in world economic markets.
So, Jim, in the time we have left, explain what your view is as to what's going on in China. We've seen the Shanghai composite, I think, correct 40%. Real estate prices are collapsing. Is this just the effect of debt excesses in China like we're seeing all around the world?
Well, first, the Chinese market has done better this year than the American stock market, and over the last year, 12 months, the Chinese stock market, I think, is the strongest stock market in the world. So, yes, it had a big drop intra-year during the period. But if you want to blame somebody, we should be blaming the American stock market or the German stock market. The Japanese markets, these have all done much worse than the Chinese market. But, yes, the Japanese market, the Chinese market went up too fast. Went up a lot very fast. Now it's had a correction. I bought shares. I went in the 3 or 4 days when it had massive collapses. I bought Chinese shares going forward, looking to the future. I've learned in my investing career that whenever you can buy panic, you should. It's usually going to be okay a year or two later. So, yes, the Chinese are having some problems right now. Then there's one major change in the world besides money printing and debt. Is that now the Chinese have debt, too. In 2008, the Chinese didn't have much debt for historic reasons, but in the last 7 years, they've built up some debt themselves. So the Chinese are not going to be able to save us like they did in 2008, because they, too, have added up a lot of debt.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Jim Rogers, author of Street Smarts, Adventures on the Road and in the Markets. And, Jim, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program again. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Dennis. Let's do it again sometime. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in today, and thanks again to our special guest today, Mr. Jim Rogers, for joining us from his home in Singapore. You know, on today's program, I'm talking about evidence that the economic winter season is advancing. And I talked about the fact that there were 10 signs that I've written about in my revised version of the New Retirement Rules book. But let me just expand on some of these things in this segment, and let me talk about the Chinese stock markets. In short, there's really no other way to put it, Chinese markets have collapsed. Why? Well, since the financial crisis, total Chinese debt has increased by more than 400%. That's a significant increase in debt. About the time of the financial crisis, total Chinese debt totaled $7 trillion. Today, total Chinese debt is approximately $28 trillion, and nearly half that debt is attributable to real estate loans and unregulated shadow banking activities. Now, it should be obvious to anyone who looks at these numbers that you can't accumulate debt by quadrupling it in 7 or 8 years. This takes us back to the eternal economic truth that if there's too much debt to be paid, it won't all be paid, and China is no exception to that rule. Now, given China's high level of debt, I believe the country will have to experience deflationary symptoms, and one deflationary symptom is a stock market correction, and it is happening now. In fact, the Shanghai Composite this year is down about 40%, and I expect there will be more significant downside for Chinese stock markets moving ahead, because I believe that China's debt bubble is just beginning to unwind. Historically speaking, when one studies bubbles, you realize that bubbles take about as long to unwind as they do to build. So I would expect not only more downside for Chinese stocks, but also more pain for the Chinese economy. To put China's debt bubble in perspective, China's local government debt, just local government debt, is now greater than the entire output of the German economy. So I expect that China will experience deflation along with the rest of the world, barring massive currency printing. However, the upside for China, in my opinion, is that I believe China's economy will be one of the first to recover, as China's debt is somewhat unique in that it is largely internal, unlike the debt of the United States. Now, when you talk about an economic winter season and you talk about debt excesses, one of the things that goes hand in hand with debt excesses are bank failures. Now, during the last financial crisis, U.S. banks, as we talked about already, were bailed out by U.S. taxpayers. However, 2 years ago, when banks in the country of Cyprus failed, there was no government bailout. Instead, there was something called a bail-in. Now, a bail-in sounds innocent and innocuous enough on the surface, but it's not. It's actually an outright confiscation of depositors' money. In Cyprus, a depositor who had more than 100,000 euros on deposit had a portion of the excess amount confiscated. The New York Times recently recounted the plight of a gentleman who managed an ad agency. The gentleman's name was Christos Savitas. Mr. Savitas lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in euros that he had on deposit with Cyprus banks, and the bad part for Mr. Savitas was this money was not even his money. It was money he had taken from clients to spend on advertising. In addition to the bail-in, Cypriot banks implemented capital controls, which limited the amount of money a depositor could withdraw in cash from his or her account. Well, that Cypriot drama is currently being played out in Greece. Greek banks have recently implemented capital controls, just like the banks in Cyprus did. There are also limitations on exporting the currency out of the country. I expect the Greek banks' financial condition to continue to deteriorate. And as of now, Greek banks are reporting that their bad loan rate is in excess of 45% of all loans made. That high percentage of bad loans is typical of debt excesses seen during an economic winter season, and the point I'm making today is that these seasons cycle and repeat themselves. In the book, New Retirement Rules, and in the update, I talk about prior economic winter seasons that have existed in the United States. These winter seasons existed in the late 1830s, the 1870s, and the 1930s, and during every one of these economic winter seasons, because debt levels got too high, because banks had made bad loans, because monetary policy was one of easy money. There were bank failures in every one of these economic winter seasons. I expect to see banking system failures continue to increase in the years ahead, and I don't think there's many countries around the world, in my opinion, that will escape the chaos. Now, what's been the response of world central banks? Well, they've printed money. Although central bankers never actually say they're creating currency out of thin air. Instead, they use terms like quantitative easing to describe their activities. But as the old saying goes, you can put perfume on a pig and it's still a pig. You can call printing currency something other than printing currency, but at the end of the day, it's still printing currency. As I discussed in my book, it's always the preferred last resort for politicians, going all the way back to 486 BC in Greece. In Argentina, money printing has occurred in earnest. There has been massive inflation in Argentina because they printed so much money. The country has no choice. After defaulting on debt for the second time in the last 15 years, the country has no access to credit markets. What does that mean? Simply put, Argentina just can't get a loan. Absent credit, absent the availability of a loan, the country has been forced to turn on the proverbial printing press. As a result, inflation in the country is now 40% annually, up from 25% annually last year. In an attempt to deal with a very high inflation rate, the Argentine government has implemented price controls since 2013. This is predictable. Historically speaking, when policymakers have printed too much money, price controls have been implemented, and price controls are used by governments to attempt to keep consumer prices in check. But they never work. If you apply just a little bit of common sense, you'll understand why. If you tell a producer of a product for how much he or she can sell the product, and it becomes impossible to produce the product and sell the product for a profit, the producer stops producing. That's what's happened in Argentina. As a result of price controls, there are shortages of groceries, and the Argentine government has begun to limit the quantities of certain items that can be purchased. The country of Venezuela is experiencing a similar economic outcome to that of Argentina as a result of massive inflation and price controls. Now, as I discuss in my book, New Retirement Rules, in an economic winter season, when there's too much debt to be paid, there's only two possible outcomes in my view. One, you get inflation followed by deflation. That's what happened in Weimar Germany. Or you simply get deflation. And as we look around the globe now, it's far easier, unfortunately, to find examples of each. Now, I've already discussed my view that I believe there will have to be more banking failures moving ahead on an even larger scale than what we've experienced to date. Let me share some of the actual numbers with you to make my point. Now, despite the fact that legislation was passed to keep the growth of the too big to fail banks in check and prevent these banks from engaging in the same risky activity that got these banks into trouble in the first place, not all that much has changed since the financial crisis. The facts show that these too big to fail banks have gotten even bigger and are still involved in the same high-risk activities that got them into trouble before. Now, when you add all the assets of the too big to fail banks together, and there are six of them, you find the total assets to be just under $10 trillion, $9.8 trillion to be exact. The total exposure to derivatives of these too big to fail banks is now $278 trillion, or about 28 times the total assets of the banks. Now, if you aren't familiar with derivatives, let me offer just a brief, maybe even admittedly oversimplified explanation. To keep it simple, a derivative is not an investment in anything. When you buy a stock, you're purchasing an ownership interest in the country, in the company. When you buy a bond, you're loaning a company money, and the assets of the company are at least partially collateralizing your loan to the company. But a derivative is different. Essentially, a derivative is a bet about what will or what will not happen in the future, such as interest rates moving up and down. Now, lest you think I'm an alarmist, Take a listen as to what one CEO of one of the two big-to-fail banks wrote to shareholders not long ago. And I'm taking one sentence out of a big, long communication. But I'm quoting, "Some things never change. There will be another crisis, and its impact will be felt by the financial market." And it's not just the two big-to-fail banks that have massive financial risk from debt overaccumulation. Worldwide, debt levels have ballooned since the financial crisis. Since 2007, worldwide debt levels have increased by more than $57 trillion. Household debt, corporate debt, government debt, and financial debt are all higher than at the beginning of the last financial crisis. This will eventually have to be, based on my study of history, deflationary on an enormously painful scale. Significant deflation has only been avoided to this point because of the colossal printing of money that has been taking place worldwide. Now, if you read the new retirement rules book, or if you decide to read the update, you'll see from our study of history in the book that money printing only delays the inevitable, and it makes the inevitable more painful. While the money creation of world central banks has delayed many of the deflationary symptoms of a severe economic winter season, ultimately, as I said, I believe we will see trade wars. I believe we'll see tremendous stock market declines. We'll see even lower labor force participation rates, lower commodity prices, and I believe we'll see fiat currency failures. We are now around the world already witnessing the beginning of each of these trends. If you'd like to learn more, let me take just a moment and remind you of a couple resources we do have available. You could request our free Investors Discovery Kit. The Discovery Kit's available by visiting the website investingapproach.com. You could also sign up for our free weekly email newsletter titled Portfolio Watch. To do that, just visit the website yourretirementoutlook.com. That's your, Y-O-U-R, retirementoutlook.com. That's our second podcast for the week. Hope you got something you can use. We'll be back again next week. Bye.